today with dealing with something that came up last time that was a very interesting question. We were talking about how fast vesicles move down axons, or in general, how fast does a vesicle get carried down a microtubule by either dynein or kinesin? And if you consider a nerve cell with its long axon full of microtubules, then of course we're talking mostly about kinesin taking it down to the end. And it turns out that vesicles move about 2 micrometers per second. So that means that for a very long neuron, it can take quite a long time to get from one end to the other, but for a short neuron, it's not that long. However, one of the points I wanted to make last time is that vesicle traffic is much, much slower than electrical signals which are sent through the membrane. We will explain how that works later, but electrical changes allow you to send a signal from the cell body all the way down to the synapse. And if you have a nerve impulse, as opposed to carrying a vesicle along a microtubule, a nerve impulse travels at a speed of between 0.1 and 100 meters. Not micrometers, not nanometers, not millimeters, but meters per second. So we're saying that electrical nerve impulses move down the nerve much, much faster than vesicles do. And the difference is somewhere around 10 to the 6th difference. It's between 5 and 7 orders of magnitude difference. So it's like a million-fold difference in speed. And one of the things that we want to discuss, and that Dr. Feierstein will talk about, is how you actually send an electrical impulse this fast from one end to the other. And I mentioned this to a colleague, and she says, of course it has to be fast. You have to get your finger out of the flame before it gets burned. Which is the cause and which is the effect is debatable, but we have evolved to have very fast nerve impulses. So I want to leave this now and talk about the question of the structure and function of the membrane itself. We said when you look at a membrane in the electron microscope, you can actually see something that looks sort of like this. If this is the plasma membrane, you see a two-layered structure. The way you stain for the electron microscope, you see 2 dark layers and a light layer. And the question is, what does this represent? Now, we know that part of it is lipid. Membranes have a core of amphipathic lipid. And amphipathic means that part of the lipid is hydrophobic and part of the lipid is hydrophilic. So that one end is engaged with other lipid-loving molecules and one is not. And such molecules are usually symbolized something like this, where the head group is hydrophilic and the tail is hydrophobic. Now, there are many different such molecules with different chemical structures making up biological membranes. And we're not going to go into it. Last semester, we did talk about the structure of a basic phospholipid based on glycerol, where this head is glycerol with phosphates and a base attached, and this tail is 1 or 2 fatty acids. But we're not going to go into the structure. We're just going to take it for granted that you have these amphipathic molecules. Now, if you have a lot of them together, they form a bilayer, meaning they form a structure like this. Now, remember, this is a slice through a 3-dimensional object. So what we're saying is they form a layer where on one half of the bilayer, or a leaflet, or one side of the bilayer or a monolayer, all the tails go down, and on the other half, all the tails go up. And in the middle, you have hydrophobic structures. So you have a very hydrophobic character in the middle. And this would be a sheet coming into and behind the board. Usually we write a cross-section of it, showing you the heads and the tails in the middle. Sometimes people write it like this to make it clear that the tail has a hydrophobic or hydrocarbon quality. Now, we're pretty sure we know that the amphipathic lipids form a bilayer. But now the question is, where are the proteins? And there are two basic models that came about as to where the proteins could be in a membrane. And the first one is usually called the unit membrane hypothesis. And the idea in the unit membrane is you have your bilayer, and then the proteins are arranged on the outside. So there's one layer of protein up here and one layer of protein down here. So you have a trilayer structure, protein, lipids, protein. And that was called a unit membrane. Now the other possibility is what is called the fluid mosaic. Now the difference is that a fluid mosaic looks like the little picture in 3B on the handout for today in the upper right. Now you notice in the fluid mosaic model, you have the same basic bilayer, but some of the protein is on one side, some of the protein is on the other side, and some of the protein goes all the way through. This is called mosaic because it's not constantly the same all across, and it's called fluid because some of the things can move around. Some of the proteins, at least, and most of the lipid can float around. So which is it? How are you going to figure that out? So the way this was figured out was by the technique which is called freeze fracture. Or its variation, which is called freeze etch. Now, the basic idea is that you have your membrane, and suppose it were like this, a unit membrane. Then you would have your two layers of protein on the two sides and lipid in the middle. Now, I left out the butter or the cheese to serve as the lipid because it's too messy. But a unit membrane is like a butter sandwich. Solid layer of protein, lipid, solid layer of protein. Now, the idea of freeze fracture is you freeze your sample and then crack it open and look at the exposed surface. Now, if we had a unit membrane, remember there's butter in the middle, and we freeze our sandwich and we give our sandwich a clop, how is it going to split? Which is more likely to split, the butter or the bread? The butter is more likely to split. And so what's going to happen is when you crack it open and you look inside, you're going to see a smooth layer, more or less. Lipids are pretty small, whether they stick up, whether they don't, it's going to look pretty smooth. Nothing big in the middle. On the other hand, what if you have the fluid mosaic model? Then rather than solid layers of bread, you really have an assortment of crackers on each side. But what's really important is that you have some proteins that go all the way through. Now, these carrots aren't quite big enough, but this is what they had in the store today. So some of the proteins go all the way through. So what happens now if you crack it open? Think about a Hershey bar with almonds. When you crack it open, what happens to the almonds? They don't break. And so the almonds either go with one side or they go with the other side. And wherever they were, there's a hole. So what's going to happen is I'm going to get something sort of like this. I'm going to have a hole where the protein used to be. And some of the proteins are going to stick up. Now notice that the protein that sticks up went all the way through to the other side. But some of them will go with this half, and some of them will go with that half. So when you look inside at the exposed surface, you're going to see bumps. And you're going to see holes. So this is diagram now on your handout on the bottom of A. That we've drawn a protein here, a membrane. And we've put in here two proteins that go through the membrane. Now we're saying if you crack the membrane open, then you can peel it off. When you crack it open, you can look at this exposed side and this exposed side. Now remember, we're talking three dimensions. So we're saying when you crack the monolayer, you can look at what was here, or you can look at what was there. You're looking here from the top. And so you're looking at the face of the membrane, the part that used to be inside. That's called the face. But there's a difference here. You notice they're labeled the E face and the P face. And that refers to the half of the membrane, the P versus E, refers to the half of the membrane that was closer to one side and one that was closer to the other. Now, how did they get these names E and P? If this were the plasma membrane, E would be on the exterior or outside of the cell. And the P would be on the side where the cytoplasm, aka protoplasm, is. So P stands for protoplasm or cytoplasm. Now, there's the E and the P half of the membrane, but here we're talking about the E and the P face. That is the inside face of the membrane that was either closer to the E side or the one that was closer to the P side. So we're looking at the inside of the monolayer. And when you actually do that, you get the result expected from the fluid mosaic model. You see holes in some spots, as shown on your handout, and you see corresponding bumps on the other side. So you would see this sticking up, and you would see this sticking up. Now, of course, this protein goes all the way to the other side. But when you look at the face, all you see is what sticks up in the electron microscope. So you would see this bump and this hole, this bump and this hole. So when people cracked open membranes, they in fact found, as expected, bumps and holes on both sides. But what was interesting, maybe I'll try and do it, is that when they actually looked, there were more bumps on the P side and more holes on the E side. Now that means that a transmembrane protein, a protein that goes all the way through, is more likely to stay with the P than it is to stay with the E. And the explanation for that is that many of these proteins, which go all the way through, are actually anchored in some way in the cytoplasm. So there's some sort of attachment, which we'll explain down here. This is somehow attached to some structure or the cytoskeleton, so that when you break it open, they are more likely to stay. Now, if we take this exact picture which we have here, it is more likely that our rectangle protein is anchored to the cytoplasm some way, and our round protein, our oval protein, is less likely to be because it goes with the E face. So we know from Fries' fracture then that we have this fluid mosaic model. And there's only one other thing I want to say about it. What is this freeze etch business? In Fries' fracture, you freeze your sample You crack it open, you shadow it so you can see in the electron microscope, and you look at the three-dimensional surface. With freeze etch, what you do is you crack your sample open, and then you allow some of the water to sublime. And then you do that before you take a picture. Now, what good does that do? Consider you have a lump of frozen soup. You crack it open. If this is pretty good soup, you know, there's a few chicken bones sticking out, there's a few carrots sticking out, but there's only a little bit. Most of it's solidly encased in ice. But now you take your sample and you let some of the water sublime off, exposing more of the carrots, the celery, the bones, and so forth. Same principle as when you have dinosaur bones buried in sand or in rock, you chisel off the surrounding rock and expose the dinosaur bones. So freeze etch allows you to sublime off some of the water, take off some of the surrounding liquid, and expose solid structures further down in the layer. But it's a variation on freeze fracture. And there are many pictures in your book and on the web which show you examples of this technique, so the kind of neat things you can see. So, now what I want to do is take a closer look at the fluid mosaic model. If a membrane really looks like this, what can we say about the various parts of it? We want to look a little bit more closely at the lipid and then at the proteins. If you look at many membranes, you find in some of them that the lipids on the two halves of the membrane, the two leaflets, are different. So that's one interesting fact. They're often different lipids on the two parts. In addition, how did the lipid get into the membrane in the first place? Lipids are generally made on the endoplasmic reticulum, and the enzymes are on the outside of the endoplasmic reticulum. So that means if we have a membrane inside the cell, here's a piece of the endoplasmic reticulum. Remember, it's a tube or a flattened sac, and this is a layer of membrane here. And now we're going to be synthesizing new lipid and sticking it into the membrane. Now, if we kept on doing that, where would the lipid be? Let's come back to our leaflet. We're saying that all the synthesis of new lipid takes place on one side. So you keep stuffing lipid into the membrane. Well, is that what you want to do? You have to put some lipid on the other side. So at least some lipid preferentially goes to the other side, some lipid stays, and some is equilibrated on both sides. How do we get a lipid molecule from one side to the other? Let's ask another question. Can the lipid move in the plane of the membrane? It can. And most lipid is free to move or float in the plane of the membrane. But to get the lipid to the other half of the membrane is not easy, because think about the energy involved here. You have a hydrophilic head that has to pass through the hydrophobic layer. So this is not favorable, and there is an energy barrier. So although lipid can float, or it can diffuse laterally, there is a barrier to its crossing to the other half of the bilayer, which is called a flip-flop usually. You can physically measure the rate at which lipids move laterally, and you can measure the rate at which they flip-flop in a plain old bilayer. And they move laterally either in a plain old bilayer or a membrane very quickly, but they flip-flop very slowly. So that means that you need an enzyme to catalyze the movement of the lipid across the membrane. And these are often called flipases. I put it in two pieces. So these allow the equilibration of the lipid on the two sides, and if they, in some cases, they use energy to push the lipid to one side or the other. So with the help of the synthetic enzymes in the cytoplasm, plus the flipases, the lipids are delivered to the appropriate part of the membrane. And then remember we said that there are vesicles, so that membranes carrying the lipid butt off from one part of the endomembrane system and can be carried to another part of the endomembrane system. Okay, that's really all I want to say about the lipids. There's a lot more to know, but that's the basic picture that we need. And now I want to look at the proteins, unless there are any questions so far. Yeah?
So the vesicle from the ER has inside of it the lipid, or the vesicle itself chooses within the membrane and acts to deal with that one?
His question is, how does a vesicle transfer lipid? It transfers the lipid not because the lipid is floating inside the vesicle, but because the lipid is part of the membrane surrounding the vesicle. And you remember the way we drew endo and exocytosis, or the equivalent. A blob of lipid forms a vesicle and buds off of one structure. And then that circle, that sphere of lipid goes and fuses with another membrane and delivers the lipid. Now, there are proteins that bind lipid and move them around, but a great deal of the lipid movement is due to the movement of vesicles. Yeah.
Maybe I misheard you, but you said that the exterior monolayer and the P monolayer, the lipids were different?
Sometimes, in some membranes, the lipids on the E side and the lipids on the P side are different. In some cases, they are the same.
Then what was the explanation for that?
The explanation for that is you have an enzyme which is coupled to the use of ATP to drive the lipid from this side to that side. Or you fail to move it, in which case it stays on the other side. Any more questions? Okay, so now let's look at the proteins that you would find in a membrane. Now, you want to look now at 3B again. Can I get someone to pull this down for me? Thank you. Thanks a lot. Okay. So, how do you look at the proteins in a membrane? Most of the methods of biochemistry are designed for the examination of soluble proteins. So it's been fairly recently that people have developed methods which allow them to look at membrane proteins. And the idea is you start with a membrane, and then what you do is you treat it with you expose it to conditions that do not dissolve the lipid bilayer, but that break weak interactions. And the usual things that you use are changes in salt or pH. Now let's go back to our picture we had of our bilayer. This little picture that's written up there in the corner, so we can refer to it. We've got a protein on the outside, a protein on the inside, a protein that goes all the way across, and a few other things to which I will return. So I'm just going to label them A, B, and C for the moment to keep track. If we were now to break weak interactions, what would happen? A and B would disassociate from the membrane because they're not covalently attached to it. They're held by weak bonds, and they would come off. And they are called extrinsic or peripheral proteins. So that's like A and B. And everything else would remain associated with the lipid. And the most obvious, these are called intrinsic or integral proteins. Now, clearly C is an integral protein. C is locked into the membrane, and unless you dissolve the lipid, you won't separate the two parts. So you'll still have the transmembrane proteins. Now, the transmembrane proteins come in two basic categories, which are called single and multipass. A single pass protein is something like this one. If your bilayer is here, this protein chain goes across the membrane once. It has a part in the cytoplasm, it has a part that goes across the membrane, and then it has the part outside. But there are also proteins which look more like this one, where, again, membrane's in the middle, and the protein goes across and back and across and back and across and back. Now, this section here could be coiled into a helix or could be extended. But the point is the protein itself, the chain goes back and forth many times. That's what's meant by a multipass protein. And we'll do an example of each in a minute. Now, these proteins can be separated, but only by dissolving the bilayer. They can be separated from the lipid, but only by dissolving the bilayer. So you have to add detergent to get them off. Now, there's another kind of protein in your picture, which I'm now going to add. These are proteins that are covalently attached to lipid. And the lipid part anchors them in the bilayer. But the protein part can be on the outside, or the protein part can be on the inside. Now, what do you call these? These were discovered after this basic procedure had been studied and after this nomenclature had been invented. So sometimes these proteins are called intrinsic proteins because unless you dissolve the bilayer, or unless you break covalent bonds, you can't get them off. But sometimes they're considered a third category of membrane-linked proteins, or lipid-anchored proteins, as it says here. And they can be inside or outside. They generally use different lipids as their anchors, depending on which they are. Now, it takes detergent, then, or to break covalent bonds to get them off. Now, we're going to largely ignore lipid-anchored proteins in this class. These are a very interesting class of proteins. They carry out some very nice functions, but we're not going to talk about them. They are mentioned briefly in your books, and they are discussed in cell biology. Now, what do these proteins look like? What do they do? How does anybody know? I want to do an actual example of how somebody started with a real membrane, took it apart, what did they find? Now, when people did this, the actual protein that they used, the actual cell type that they used, were red blood cells. Now, in your notes, there is a list of the various kinds of proteins, of transmembrane proteins, of their important features. And I think we'll illustrate that by looking at what you really get if you take a real membrane and you take it apart. Now, if you want to take a cell and take it apart and isolate its membranes, what cell type are you going to use? Of course, any eukaryotic cell will contain membranes. But most eukaryotic cells contain a plasma membrane and a nuclear envelope and an endoplasmic reticulum and a Golgi. So you're going to get a mixture of membranes. So people instead started with red blood cells or erythrocytes. Red blood cells are available in large quantities cheap. And that's because you get expired blood from a blood bank. And it's easy to get cheap. But the real advantage of a red blood cell in this context, a red blood cell, by the way, looks something like this. This is, I forget the exact magnification, and of course the eyes are an addition. But the point that this illustrates is that it's sort of disc-shaped with an indentation in the middle. And it deforms as it squeezes through your capillaries or very fine blood vessels. So this is sort of the shape of a red blood cell. But the thing that's unique about human red blood cells is they have no internal membranes. They don't have an ER, they don't have a Golgi, they don't have a nucleus, they don't have mitochondria. What happens is their precursor cells are normal, ordinary cells. But as they are maturing into red blood cells, they jettison all that other stuff. Most of the stuff that is not essential to their function is degraded and lost. So that a red blood cell contains no internal membranes. And the major protein inside is hemoglobin, but not the only one. If you want to, you can think of a red blood cell as a package of hemoglobin for carrying oxygen. Now, as we'll see, it serves another function as well. But most of the other stuff is lost. Now, another reason for using red blood cells is it's relatively easy to get rid of whatever is left inside besides the membrane. If you put red blood cells in water, so here's your red blood cell, what happens is that the water gets inside the cell and the cell swells and the cell cracks a leak. So it's in water. The water rushes in because the cell has salts and material inside. Because of the osmotic differences, water rushes into the cell. And then the cell breaks open. And now all the materials can be washed out of the cell, leaving only the membrane and nothing else. And when you wash everything out, you can reseal the little crack in the membrane. But now what you basically have is an empty cell. It's just a membrane, a plasma membrane, with whatever proteins were stuck to it, and everything else is gone. Now, red blood cells are red because of hemoglobin. So these aren't red anymore. And in fact, they look sort of ghost-like or whitish, and so they're called ghosts. And they are really only a ghost of their previous self because almost all the internal proteins are gone. One of the cool things about resealing these membranes is they can be resealed in either orientation by using the right concentrations of buffers. So if we put something here to make it sort of clear which side of the membrane is which, you can reseal ghosts like this, or you can reseal them inside out. I don't know if you can get whole cells inside out, but you can certainly get vesicles of membrane that are inside out. Now, the point of this is you can now do chemical tests to say what sticks out this time and what's protected. what sticks out this time, and what's protected. And that allows you to figure out what is on what side of the membrane relatively easily. So for all of these technical reasons, people started out by looking at the membranes of red blood cells. And of all plasma membranes, the plasma membrane of the red blood cell is the best understood. So the first thing that people did was to take the cells, really the ghosts, and expose them to salt and pH and see what they could wash off. Well, would you expect they would wash off anything? If there is a protein, a peripheral protein, attached to the inside, underneath, supporting the membrane, that will be washed off. And in fact, there is such a protein. There are several of them. When you start with red blood cell ghosts, you get peripheral proteins called spectrin. Now, you should take out your handout again, because these proteins are on your handout, and you can see how they're arranged. So now you have to look at 3B in the middle. The peripheral proteins were down here, inside the cell, non-covalently attached to the membrane. And you see we've written down here series of fibers, and then something looks like this, and something that looks like this. Now, just for the picture, I'm going to put in, this is one transmembrane protein, and this is another. And we're going to explain what each of these is. Now, when you add high salt or you alter the pH, you knock off these peripheral proteins and the side that were inside the cell, but the transmembrane proteins remain attached to the membrane. Now, what are these peripheral proteins underneath the membrane? This protein here, which forms a sort of web, is called spectrin. Spectrin was first discovered in red blood cells, but a similar protein, spectrin is a member of a family, and similar proteins are found under the plasma membrane and under membranes in many, many other cells. Apparently, almost every membrane has a web-like structure underneath, supporting it. Remember that there are lamins underneath the nuclear membrane or the nuclear envelope. Underneath the plasma membrane, there is spectrin or spectrin-like proteins. Now, what holds this web together are very short microfilaments, and that's what this is. This is a very short microfilament, in other words, actin. It's a polymer, but a very short one. Now, some of these proteins have names, and some of these proteins just have numbers. Because when people first did this, they took red blood cell ghosts, and they actually dissolved them in detergent, and then they took all those proteins from the membrane and they ran it on a gel. And they numbered them protein 1, protein 2, protein 3, protein 4, etc. They had no idea what they were. This protein, for example, which is a very famous protein, is sometimes called BAM3 protein, although we now have another name for it. Most of these others have names, but there is one protein which is still called band 4. It's called protein 4-1. It's found here, and it's found at the end of the short actins. 4-1 means when they looked at band 4 carefully, they realized that it was several other bands, several smaller bands stuck to, right next to each other. So this is called often just band 4-1, and you'll see it in many of the pictures, and it appears to glue other things together. So it holds the spectrin and the actin together, and it also anchors some transmembrane proteins. There is one other major peripheral protein here. There is spectrin. There is, of course, the short microfilaments or actin. And then there is this protein we've called ankyrin. That is this one. It is named ankyrin because its job is to anchor the band 3 transmembrane protein. It connects the bottom of the band 3 protein to this web. Now, in a cell with irregular internal organelles, this web is connected to the major cytoskeleton. But in red blood cells, there is no major cytoskeleton. In human red blood cells, there are no microtubules, there are no long actins, there are no intermediate filaments. So this web is all you've got. Now you notice that both of these transmembrane proteins, both of these integral proteins are anchored. One is anchored by ankyrin, one is anchored by a different protein. Therefore, if we freeze fractured this membrane, most of these transmembrane proteins would come with the P side, not with the other half. Now, it might be clearer how the spectrin and the ankyrin are arranged if we look from another point of view. This is a piece of a cell. The cell is spherical or disc shaped, and we've made a cross section. We've done a chomp through our red blood cell. But what if we look down on the top? If we were to look on the top, it would be clearer from the top that the spectrin forms a kind of network. And that at the joints in the network, you have actin, those short microfilaments, and 4-1 holding it together. So it looks something more like this. So this is a top view as versus a side view. And there are pictures of both in your texts. Now, these are the peripheral proteins of the red blood cell. They are typical of the peripheral proteins of most membranes, though we'll meet some others. But now I want to look at the transmembrane proteins. These two are the major transmembrane proteins of the red blood cell, and they illustrate the two categories which we drew before. This protein is a single-pass protein, while band 3 is a multi-pass. Now, these proteins actually have names. The single-pass protein is called glycophorin. And the band proper name for the band 3 protein is the anion exchanger. So we want to look at their basic properties or structure first, and then we want to look at their function. Let me say right off that glycophorin is the major protein of the red blood cell membrane, and its function is unknown. We think we have some good intelligent guesses, but we don't really know. On the other hand, the function of the anion exchanger is very clear and very important, and we'll explain what it is. Okay. So what are the features now of these transmembrane proteins that we want to be sure we've got straight? If we look back at that little list on our notes, we see that they can be single versus multi. And then you have to take into account their domains. Let's look first at the single pass protein. We said with our yellow model over there that it actually has three separate parts. It has a part that belongs in the membrane, that's embedded in the membrane, a part that sticks out of the cell, and a part that sticks into the cytoplasm. So these are called three separate domains of the protein. If we were to draw the protein with this kind of representation, the way that we drew the intermediate filaments last time, we would say that this protein has three domains. Now, I don't remember, in this case, I think the amino end, in some of these proteins, the amino end is outside, and some of these proteins, the carboxyl end is outside. It can be either way. I think in this one, the amino end is outside. So this would be the extracellular domain, which would represent this part. Then we'd have the transmembrane domain, which would be this part. Sometimes just called TM for transmembrane. And then we would have the intracellular domain, which corresponds to the part that sticks into the cytoplasm. Now, what about with a multipass protein? A multipass protein like this would have multiple extracellular domains and multiple intracellular domains. So if I drew it this way, it would look quite different. So this would be, say, extracellular and intracellular. This would be transmembrane. And this would be intracellular, and this would have to be transmembrane again, and this would be extracellular, etc. So it would be, well, if I start like this, extracellular, transmembrane, intracellular domain, another transmembrane domain, extracellular domain, etc. Now, as you might expect, the properties of the various domains are different in terms of the types of amino acids which they contain. The amino acids which associate with or stick into the membrane tend to have hydrophobic side chains, while the amino acids in the extracellular and intracellular domains, at least the parts that stick out, tend to have water-soluble domains. How these proteins function in transport, we'll talk about another time. Some of the transport proteins are folded to form like a circle, to form a kind of pore that goes across the membrane. Now, how would you expect the side chains to be? If water-soluble things can move through, as you might expect, there are water-soluble side chains sticking into the middle. But this part is stuck into the membrane, into the lipid. So that has hydrophobic side chains sticking out. Now, whether a protein is single-pass or multi-pass, the extracellular domains are often modified by the addition of short branched carbohydrate chains. And those are symbolized on your handout by these structures. So this is where the carbos are. They're always on the extracellular domains. Now, the reason for that has to do with the way they're made. Later in the course, we will discuss how you make these proteins and how you get them into the membrane. And it turns out that in their passage through the cell, only this side is exposed to the enzymes that add carbohydrates. So that's why there are only carbohydrates on the extracellular domain, never on the intracellular or transmembrane domains. Now, what about anchorage? Both of our proteins are anchored. Now, that isn't true for all transmembrane proteins, but many, many of them are anchored in some way to the spectrin web or to the cytoskeleton. Now, before we go any further, I should say just something about structure, which I forgot to mention earlier. If in the case of a single pass protein, the part, the transmembrane part that grows across the membrane is usually an alpha helix. And it takes about 25 amino acids to make an alpha helix long enough to be the width of a proper bilayer. When you have a protein which is multipass, one possibility is the protein is extended, and this is a kind of beta sheet. Another possibility, though, is that the protein has multiple alpha helices. So this is one alpha helix, then this part sticks out on outside the cell. This is another alpha helix, goes across the membrane. Then this part sticks out inside the cell. Then you have another alpha helix, etc. So the transmembrane part can be an alpha helix each time. Now, what are the functions of these transmembrane proteins? As I said, we do not know what the function of glycophorin is. We do know what the function of the anion exchanger is. It's a transport protein. And many of these proteins in the membrane are transport proteins. Some of them form pores, so which things can pass. And some of them are more like doors, more like revolving doors. A pore is more like a plain door. You open it, things can go through. A revolving door is more complicated. Only things which fit can move, and it has moving parts. This protein here looks like a simple pore in my picture, but it actually has moving parts. It's more like a revolving door. And it's called an exchanger because two different things have to pass through it, one in each direction, as we will explain in some detail. But there is a whole class of transport proteins that promote the movement of things from one side of a membrane to another. Remember, a membrane has a hydrophobic core. Therefore, hydrophilic substances cannot pass unaided across a membrane. And they require some kind of door or pump or something to help them move. And how that works, we'll start talking about next time. Now, another possibility is that these proteins are receptors. If the transport protein is a door or a pump, a receptor is a trap. Something floating around here, either outside the cell, in the environment, or in the fluids of the body surrounding the cell, something sticks to the extracellular domain, and then something happens, which varies a lot, which we'll discuss. One possibility can be just to send a signal to the inside of the cell to do something. One possibility is the material which is trapped can be grabbed and brought inside. But the proteins that do that, that bind something, and that has consequences, those are called receptors. Now, we do know that glycophorin acts as a receptor for certain kinds of malaria. Is that its normal function? To help you get malaria? No way. We don't know what the real job of this protein is, but the malaria parasite reproduces inside the red blood cell. And the malaria parasite can bind to this protein. And so changes in this protein can in fact lead to changes in resistance to malaria. That's how we discovered this. Many proteins act as receptors for various infectious agents. Like there's an HIV receptor. Now that's not there to give you AIDS. That's because the AIDS virus has evolved to match a protein on the surface of your cells, which it uses as a trapdoor to get inside. Similarly, the malaria parasite has evolved to match the glycophorin so that it can use it to get inside. But to repeat, we really don't know what the real function of this protein is. Now, we will meet many other proteins whose real receptor function is known and how that works. Now, there's one other kind of protein that we've mentioned here, which I've called a linker. And I probably should call it a connector. There are proteins whose job it is to make connections between the stuff on the outside of the cell and the stuff on the inside. There is both extracellular material floating around here, which is sometimes linked, and there can be another cell out here. So what some proteins do is their extracellular domain links to either the extracellular domain of a protein from another cell, or it links to the extracellular material. And these proteins then serve to connect what's inside the cell to what's outside the cell. And we will meet some examples of that either today or tomorrow. So these transmembrane proteins can be for transport, for receptor of signals or taking things in, or they can be some kind of connectors. Now the two we've written here, as we've said, we're not sure what the job of glycophorin is, but we know a lot about this multipass protein here. And I would like to talk a little bit more about its function. This protein the anion exchanger because what it catalyzes is the transport of two ions, anions, in opposite directions. And those are bicarbonate ion and chloride ion. So this protein, band 3, is also called the bicarb chloride exchanger or the chloride bicarb exchanger, as well as the anion exchanger. And before we talk any more about structures of things, we want to talk briefly about why this protein is so important in the operation of the human body. In other words, what is it good for? This protein is involved in the transport of carbon dioxide, or CO2. Remember we said that a red blood cell can be thought of as a package of hemoglobin, in which case its job is to carry oxygen. But your blood does things two ways. Your blood carries oxygen into your cells, but it also carries CO2 away. Now, why do your cells make CO2? Remember oxidative metabolism? If you break down glucose first to pyruvate, and then you finish the job, and you go through the Krebs cycle, oxphos, electron transport, etc., your carbon all ends up as CO2. So when cells are metabolizing oxidatively, you get large amounts of CO2 from the cells. Your tissues are generating CO2 all the time. And that CO2 has to be transported by the blood back to your lungs where it can be breathed out. And the question is, how are we going to do that? And the catch is that CO2 is not very soluble in liquid such as the blood. So if you just, CO2 is a gas, and gases can pass through membranes. So the CO2 can get out of the cells which make it, and it can get into your bloodstream. But it's not very soluble. So just the amount of CO2 your blood could carry away is quite limited. And yet, you know you do it. So how do you pull it off? It turns out that this exchanger is critical because it allows you to convert the CO2 into bicarb. And bicarb is very soluble. So this anion exchanger is critical in allowing you to convert CO2 into a form in where it can be carried by the blood. Now, the whole job requires, actually, not only the anion exchanger, but another protein. To convert CO2 to bicarb, you need an enzyme. And that enzyme is located inside your red blood cells. Now, the picture of this is on the handout again. It's on the bottom of 3B. So here we have a red blood cell. We're looking at it from the side, this way. And you can sort of see the indentation. Inside the red blood cell is an enzyme called carbonic anhydrase, which is one of the most effective, fastest enzymes known. And it catalyzes the reaction CO2 plus water, give you bicarb and protons. Now, we've already said that CO2 is a gas and it can pass membranes. So if your tissues make CO2, the CO2 can enter the red blood cell. There, the CO2 can be converted to bicarb. We said that bicarb is very soluble. So if we could put the bicarb into the liquid part of the blood, that is the plasma, blood contains the cells and the liquid part, or the plasma. If we could get this bicarb back into the plasma, then we could take more CO2, make it to bicarb, put it in the plasma, and the plasma could soak up as much CO2 as we need to in the form of bicarb. So there's a catch, though. How are we going to get the bicarb out of the cell? And that's where this anion exchanger serves a critical role. This protein allows one molecule of bicarb to exchange for one molecule of chloride. So the bicarb can leave and chloride can enter. So what is happening in your tissues is the CO2 is coming out of your tissues into the red blood cells. It's being made into bicarb. And then the bicarb is leaving in exchange for chloride. So the bicarb is building up in your plasma. And then the plasma carries it around to your lungs, where the process reverses. Because all these steps are reversible. Now, to be sure everybody's got this, suppose you have two red blood cells. This one is in your lungs. This one is in the blood vessels in your tissues. So these are both in blood vessels, of course, but the blood vessel is in your tissue or the blood vessel is in your lungs. Which way does the CO2 go? Which way does the bicarb go? And which way does the chloride go in each case? So I want you to try it. Just take out a piece of paper and write it down and compare it to the person next to you and see if you can get it right. What is happening to the cell in the red blood cell in the lung? What is happening to the red blood cell in the tissue in terms of these three? Are they going in or are they going out? What are they doing? Oh, quiet in here. I strongly recommend checking with the person next to you whether you're sure or not. Thank you. right then. So actually, we just did the tissues. So in this red blood cells and the tissues, which way does the CO2 go in? It's going in. And the bicarb?
Goes out.
And that requires the anion exchanger. And then what does the chloride do? Well, the chloride must go in exchange for the bicarb. But what's happening in your lungs? The whole thing in your tissues is going to the right and down. In your lungs, it's going up and left. Because you're pulling, what's happening to the CO2? It's going out. Because what's happening is you're breathing out CO2. So the CO2 concentration in the plasma is low. So that pulls the CO2 out of your red blood cell. So the CO2 goes out. But if the CO2 is low in your red blood cell, what happens to the equilibrium of the carbionic anhydrase reaction? Which way? It goes that way, because we pulled out the CO2. And so more bicarb converts to CO2, but you're going to run out of bicarb. Where are you going to get more bicarb from? Remember, the bicarb is floating in the plasma. So what does the bicarb have to do? It has to come in exchange for the chloride that goes out. So this is very important in the transport of gases. Now, just a few more words about glycophorin. We said we don't really know what it's for. One thing that is worth mentioning, besides the fact that the glycophorins are actually a family of proteins, there's not just one, is that notice the carbohydrate we put on here? This is highly modified, and it has a lot of negative charges on it. And some people think that the point of having the glycophorin is that it makes the red blood cell negatively charged so your red blood cells don't stick to each other. Another possibility is that these carbohydrate chains are slowly eaten off as the cell ages, and that's how you know your old red blood cells from your young red blood cells and turn them over properly. So these are both guesses. We're not really sure. Now, we will meet many more cases of these two proteins as we go, but I want to leave now the membrane itself and talk a little bit about the extracellular matrix, what is outside the cells. So let me ask if there are any questions before I do that. Yeah, go ahead.
Knowing the theories about the glycophorin, is that more biology or is that important?
She wants to know if you have to know on an exam what glycophorin is for. And I'm not going to tell you the answer. Okay. Nobody knows, right? Let's consider now what's on the outside of the cell. Now, we tend to think of what really counts as what's inside, but it turns out that the major protein in your body is outside your cells, and that's collagen. You have more collagen than anything else. Collagen is what makes your nose what it is. It's responsible for a lot of connective tissue. It's in your skin. It's a major protein. So a lot of your protein is made, it's all made by your cells, but a lot of it is extruded from your cells and put into the spaces in between. And so that's really important. So I want to talk a little bit about the extracellular matrix. And to summarize, you want to look on the other side of your handout, the second panel down. We're not going to do all the details, but we're going to talk about a couple of the famous proteins and the famous categories. There are three categories of proteins you need to know about in the extracellular matrix. One class is structural, and collagen is an example of that, the most famous one. Another are what are called adhesive, and a third are what are called proteoglycans. Now, structural proteins are exactly what they say they are. They are proteins that maintain the structure, and they add physical support. And the two most famous ones are collagen and elastin. In your skin, collagen is what provides strength, and elastin, the flexibility or elastic nature of it, And with aging, the collagen gets cross-linked, and the elastin gets degraded or lost. And that's why the skin in older people is not so resilient. Now, none of you have to worry about that yet, but it does happen. So these two are important structural proteins. So you have these structural proteins. If you have your cell, and the cell has transmembrane proteins, there are these structural proteins outside in the extracellular matrix. But now what holds it all together are these so-called adhesive proteins, which are sort of connecting things. They're both connecting the transmembrane protein extracellular domain to the structural proteins and the structural proteins to each other. And there are many such, but the two most famous ones of this are fibronectin and laminin. And I mentioned this before, this has a name like the lamins, but it's a different protein. And these are the two most famous adhesive proteins. And these are all glycoproteins. The short sugar chains on the outside probably contribute to their glue effect. Now, how did laminin get a name like laminin? As most of the extracellular matrix is a kind of gel-like material made up by the third category, the proteoglycans, with these other things embedded in it. But some parts of the extracellular matrix form a kind of solid mat, and that's called the basal lamina. And laminin is one of the major proteins in there, and that's how it got its name. And the basal lamina used to be called a basement membrane. Because sometimes when you have cells, you have under the cell, you have a layer of cells, and then underneath you have this mat. And so when you look in a microscope, you see a layer. So people called it a basement membrane because it was underneath. But it's not a membrane in the sense it does not contain a bilayer of lipid. It's only proteins. And so it's customary in more recent literature, it is always called the basal lamina, meaning a layer, instead of a membrane. And we'll meet an example of that next time. Now I just want to say a few words about proteoglycans. There is an extensive table in your notes, which has a lot of detail in it, and this one is largely FYI. Some of the things that we mention here, we mention so that when you go and you read, you will understand what the heck they are talking about, not so that you can memorize all the details. And I want to just say a little word about the difference between a respectable glycoprotein and a proteoglycan. Both of these have a protein part and a sugar part. But glycoproteins are respectable proteins that have short branched sugars attached to them. Now they can have a lot of it. It can make up a large proportion of the weight of the molecule, but they're still respectable proteins underneath. Proteoglycans are quite different. As I said, they form a gel-like matrix. And they're really mostly sugar and very little protein. And their sugar chains are long and linear, and they repeat. So there'll be two sugars, and they'll go A, B, A, B, A, B, A, B, A, B, for a long chain. And the sugars are usually modified. That is, they have things like aminos and sulfates and stuff on them. Now, you know what a glycoprotein looks like. Looks like this. It's a respectable protein, and then on its extracellular domain has, or if it's outside, that's all of it, it has these little short branch chains. But what a proteoglycan looks like is really quite different. What it looks like is a little bit of protein and then very long carbohydrate chains. So this is the protein part, and this is the AB sugar part. So there are these multiple long repeating chains attached to this little tiny core of protein. And then a bunch of these can be stuck to each other, but we're not going to draw that, although that's in your picture. So there is a reference table in your notes explaining these differences. These turn out to be very important in maintaining the structure of the extracellular matrix, but we're not going to talk about them very much. You've probably heard, though, of heparin, which is used in a blood bank as an anticoagulant, although that's probably not its real job. And you've also probably heard of chondroitin sulfate. Chondroitin sulfate is found in the lubricants in your joints, and some people think that if you have arthritis and you take it, it makes you better. Now, it's debatable whether it does, but it probably can't hurt, as they say. And it actually, the heparin and the chondroitin sulfate actually make up these chains. So all of this is explained in the notes and in the table and is largely for reference. Now, we did not get to the cell-cell connections, and that's what we'll talk about next time. If you have a protein protruding from the cell and you have a protein protruding from another cell, how do they connect? And in addition, how does this cell, this protein, connect to the extracellular matrix? So those kinds of connections we'll talk about next time, and then we'll talk about transfer. Mm-hmm.